demonstration time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome once again to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak, and tonight we're bringing some very fine progressive journalists. But first, we've got Susan Booker, the Supervisor of Elections for Palm Beach County, and she's going to talk a little bit about the last dog and pony show the Secretary of State brought out to try to convince Supervisors of Elections that all this new trimming, this new streamlining, this new cut down on the voting rolls, this is the good one. Here is Susan Booker, Supervisor of Elections, West Palm Beach. Good afternoon, Ms. Booker. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Very good. I want to thank you for the fine work that you've been doing to help Floridians vote. You have a lot of responsibility, and goodness knows in this state, helping people vote can be a very difficult thing.
Well, I don't think it should be. You know, I believe strongly that voting is a benchmark to our democracy, and as Americans, we have not only the privilege, but the responsibility to come out and vote. My job is to make it easier, to make ease and access for our constituents.
For for the audience, why don't you go ahead and give our audience your title, please?
I'm Susan Booker, and I'm the Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections.
Well, as many people are aware here in Florida, it seems that our Republican governors are just so interested in finding the missing, elusive, illegal voter, a figure who seems to be completely non-existent. And yet, try they may to find one. And I understand the governor has sent off the Secretary of State to do a tour to speak to all the Supervisors of Elections to help them understand why the new purge is so necessary.
Well, the Secretary concluded the last of his five stops throughout the state where most of the supervisors attended. And his last show was in Fort Lauderdale a couple days ago. And, you know, what the law requires when you're identifying a potential voter who should not have registered to vote is it requires the state to provide us supervisors credible and reliable information. That's in state law in the state of Florida. And then the state law additionally requires that the Supervisor of Elections makes the final determination based upon a preponderance of evidence. And so, you know, there's nobody that wants a cleaner voter file than a supervisor. We send out voter registration cards and sample ballots, and we allocate voting locations based on the voting population in certain territories. So, you know, every off election year, such as this one in 2013, we actually, and this is set in law as well, we send out notices to individuals who have not appeared to vote in at least two general elections or the last 4 years. And we notice them to say, you know, are you still out there? Would you like to continue to be registered? And if we don't hear back from them, then we put them as an inactive voter. Now, any time that they come to vote or they call us or any contact, we'll make them active again. But after a total of four general elections or 8 years, we actually are required by law to send a certified letter. And if they still don't respond, we publish their name in the newspaper with notice, and we actually remove those voters. So it's a very long process. And we're also responsible to take a look at felons and mentally incapacitated individuals and deceased individuals. And in every single one of those three cases, we get credible and reliable information from the Division of Elections Secretary of State's office, like a death certificate or the court records. And so, you know, last year we got a very large list, and it just was a spreadsheet. And when I, as a supervisor, took a look, and that was the first non-citizen voter purge, it started out to be 182,000 people statewide. And, you know, the data was sometimes over a decade old. It came from the Department of Highway Safety, and it was not credible, nor was it reliable information. So I made a determination not to continue with that information. eventually there was a lawsuit, and the lawsuit agreement was that the secretary and the Division of Elections discontinued using those records and trying to encourage the supervisors to use them to purge voters. It turns out that there were many Americans on those lists, and the lists were extremely faulty. So this time, the Division of Elections actually sued the Department of Homeland Security to gain access to a program that is called SAVE. And it's a SAVE program that they've put together to determine the immigration status of individuals for certain benefits. But at the same time that I say that, everything I've read about this SAVE program, including the back and forth from the Department of Justice and the Division of Elections last year, is that you require an alien number that they assign to immigrants in order to just even access the program. And then what the documentation says is that you may need to provide a copy of their immigration certificate or other documents to do a more thorough search. And so when I went to the meeting in Fort Lauderdale, I simply wanted to have two very generalized questions answered. That is, where does this data come from? Who feeds into the SAVE program that they want us to use? And they weren't able to answer that question. And then my next, what I consider very important question was, how often does the database get updated? Because if it's not updated, then we perhaps would send out notice to somebody who has become a citizen. And I didn't get that question answered either. And, you know, the state doesn't have a very solid track record when it comes to identifying federal and state felons or identifying deceased individuals. So we have a pretty long history. You know, in the year 2000, the state popped out with over 110,000 people who they claimed were felons. They had hired a private company to scrub the list at that time, and they had to abandon that effort. And in 2004, they had another similar effort for people who were felons, and they had to abandon that effort too. And then last year, of course, they abandoned the non-citizen voter purge because they couldn't prove that it was credible nor reliable information. So before we get started with this, I just think that, you know, I have a due diligence as a supervisor to make sure that we're in compliance with the law. And that compliance is very straightforward. It's credible and reliable information from the state.
Well, so I understand that at the beginning of the tour, they were taking questions and there was a lot of feedback, but toward the end of the tour, they basically stopped answering questions. So the sense you have from the information they're providing you is that this purge isn't going to go any better for them than the last several.
Well, if they don't know where the database information came from and they don't know how often it's upgraded or updated, I don't think that we can move forward until we at least have those very elementary questions answered. So after the interchange between the secretary and I and the staff, I asked if they could provide us with who their contact was at the Department of Homeland Security. We are having a Supervisor of Elections conference with all the supervisors in the state in December, and I'm hopeful that we will bring somebody from Homeland Security that does have some data about where this comes from, because there are several reports that indicate that just because you have an alien verification number and you run it through this program, you might need to supplement that with additional documentation. And I want to make sure that, number one, if this is the first step, what other steps or safeguards should we be taking to make sure that we don't identify actual citizens who were born in the United States like we did last year?
Well, Ms. Booker, I want to thank you so much. It's always great to hear you, your perspective, and you're doing such an important role for our democracy, and to hear the diligence that you're pursuing it, I have to just say for the voters of the Palm Beach region, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. We're just, you know, doing our responsibility in accordance with the law, and that's part of the due diligence. And I'm, you know, the supervisor. I believe strongly in the ability to vote, and certainly we don't want anybody to vote who's not allowed to vote or should not authorized to register. But I think that we have a responsibility to all of the citizens in the state of Florida and all throughout the country to make sure that we're not targeting a particular audience because they don't have propensity to support us.
Thanks again, and you have a very good day. And keep up the good work, please.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, as you know, tonight's episode is focused on progressive news media, progressive press. We have some very fine examples of that. We've got Steve Horn, a Madison, Wisconsin-based investigative journalist. He's a research fellow at the Smog Blog and a contributing editor at Counterpunch. We've got Frank Day, North Florida progressive activist, longtime Democratic leader. We've got Rob Abston, executive director and founder of PLAN, that's Progressive Leadership Action Network, and also host of a fine progressive news show called Smile, It's Only Politics. And we've got Gwen Holden Berry, progressive journalist and activist, senior producer and host of There Be Monsters, and Hans Meyer, progressive broadcaster and journalists from the Tallahassee area. But before we get to that, we have to talk about the issue du jour. And, of course, I brought a little clip of Senator Warren talking about the so-called shutdown. Here's Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Madam President, I come to the floor today in a state of disbelief. With millions of people out of work, with an economic recovery still far too fragile, with students and families being crushed by student loan debt, with millions of seniors denied their chance at one hot meal a day with Meals on Wheels, and millions of little children pushed out of Head Start because of a sequester, with the country hours away from a government shutdown and days away from a potential default on the nation's debt, the Republicans have decided that the single most important issue facing our nation is to change the law so that employers can deny women access to birth control coverage. In fact, letting employers decide whether women can get birth control covered on their insurance plans is so important that the Republicans are willing to shutter the government and potentially tank the economy over whether women can get access to birth control in the year 2013, not the year 1913, the year 2013. I have a daughter and I have granddaughters, and I will never vote to let a group of backward-looking ideologues cut women's access to birth control. We have lived in that world and we are not going back. Not ever. This assault on birth control is just one more piece of an ongoing Republican assault on the orderly functioning of our government and the orderly functioning of our economy. In effect, the Republicans are trying to take the government and the economy hostage, threatening serious damage to both unless the president agrees to gut the Affordable Care Act. I see things like this, and I wonder what alternate reality some of my colleagues are living in. So let me be very clear about what is happening in the real world. The ACA is the law of the land. Millions of people are counting on it. People who need health care coverage, people who need insurance policies that don't disappear just when they are at their sickest. Women will get insurance coverage for birth control. The law is here to stay, and it will stay. Earlier today, the Senate emphasized that reality by flatly rejecting the Republicans' newest ransom note, just as we did last week. Now, we are just hours from the government running out of money. We haven't fixed the sequester because of all the obstruction. We haven't finished a budget because of all the obstruction. We haven't even passed a single appropriations bill because of all the obstruction. The least we can do, the bare minimum that we can do, would be to pass a continuing resolution to keep the doors open and the lights on. We can ensure that over 1 million federal workers aren't simply sent home for no reason. We can avoid a government shutdown. But the Republicans have refused to do even that. They have continued to threaten to shutter the government unless the president agrees to gut the Affordable Care Act. The Senate rejected that position twice, yet the Republican response has been to continue to threaten to shut the government down. These threats may continue, but they are not working, and they will never work, because this is democracy. And in a democracy, hostage tactics are the last resort for those who can't win their fights through elections, can't win their fights in Congress, can't win their fights for the presidency, and can't win their fights in the courts. For this right-wing minority, hostage-taking is all they have left, a last gasp of those who cannot cope with the realities of our democracy. The time has come for those legislators who cannot cope with the reality of our democracy to get out of the way so that those of us in both parties who understand that the American people sent us here to work for them can get back to work solving real problems faced by the American people. We have real work to do, and that's what we should be doing. Thank you, Madam President.
That was the very wise and plain-spoken Senator Elizabeth Warren. And now this brief clip of Edward Snowden from WikiLeaks describing something he calls the fundamental dangers. It's a real quick, short clip, so listen carefully. Edward Snowden from WikiLeaks talking about the fundamental dangers our country is facing.
We have an executive of the Department of Justice that's unwilling to prosecute high officials who lied to Congress and the country on camera, but they'll stop at nothing to persecute someone who told them the truth. And that's fundamentally the difference in the United States.
And now, this clip is from the World Bank whistleblower who has brought us some real insight into what's really going on in the World Bank.
Our guest today is whistleblower Karen Hughes, former senior counselor at the World Bank. Karen, it's great to have you on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Sophie. I'm glad to be with you.
So the government shutdown, is the move on the part of the Republicans justified? Is fighting off Obamacare worth all this mess?
I think there's something more going on behind the scenes. A lot more, actually.
What do you mean?
Well, there is a terrible currency problem. We're on the verge of a currency war. The Federal Reserve is printing dollars like there's no tomorrow, and if they keep going, the rest of the world is not going to accept them. As it is, the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, have decided that they're going to finance the trade among these countries with offsets and pay for the difference in gold. And
but
this
how is that connected
the
with
right
the shutdown,
move for them
though?
Because the U.S. Congress has been fighting with the presidency because the presidency has been in total contempt. And the highest legal officer of the United States government has also been in contempt of Congress in fighting this international corruption that is ruining the dollar as an international reserve currency.
But, you know, economists have been predicting the dollar will fall ever since the crisis in 2008. But the government has managed to keep it afloat.
Well, not for long. If you look at what's going on in the gold and other precious metals markets, silver as well, we're headed towards something called permanent gold backwardation. That means that there's a loss in confidence in the fiat currencies that are issued by those private banks. They like to consider themselves as public banks, but they're really owned by private entities. And these currencies are about to crash because they are valueless. That's what always happens to paper currencies that aren't backed by assets.
Mm-hmm. But well, like you've mentioned, gold backwardation. Gold is often chanted as perfectly safe investment, an alternative to the dollar even. But how come the price of gold is falling?
because of market manipulation. But that can only continue for so long because the central banks are running out of gold and the rest of the world are lining up to buy them. If you want to buy gold today, you have to pay a premium. What they're offering in the future is called a naked short. They don't have the gold to back those offers. That's illegal what they're doing.
I will get back to gold in a bit, but for now I would like to focus on Obamacare. In your opinion, is Obamacare really that crucial for the U.S. economy?
What you have is something that's very good for the medical insurers, because most of the other countries that offer medical coverage do this through a single issuer. And that's not what we have here. What we have here is a bill that was drafted by the medical insurance companies. It's not good for this economy. It never was.
But why? Why do you say it's not good?
Because what's happening is the workers that worked full-time are being put deliberately on part-time basis so that the companies can avoid giving them medical insurance coverage under the provisions of the law.
You know, this Obamacare thing, I've heard it many times being compared to socialism, communism sometimes even. Do you trace the resemblance?
That's just because the mainstream media, when they report about what's going on, are doing it by telling lies and anything that's good for the powers that be. The mainstream media is completely owned and controlled by the same companies, private companies, that own the Federal Reserve System. Most of the American citizens are clueless about the corruption that's rifling their economy.
But just to make sure, are you saying that everything about Obamacare is bad? Or are there good things about it?
No, of course there are good things about it. But the problem is that the people that wanted to get a decent coverage were not given the tools. They were not given the equipment. They were not given the press coverage, the honest press coverage that a society needs to enact just legislation. Their congresspeople are all bribed by these corrupt forces.
So at
and
this
the
point,
American citizens have zero confidence in their Congress.
So at this point, you side with the Republicans for blocking the Medicare.
I'm not siding with Democrats or Republicans because both of those parties have been co-opted by this terrible corrupt force that I'm talking about.
What we have right now is Americans being forced to get health insurance. How does that go with their love of liberties and freedom of choice?
It's not so much a question of being forced. You have to look at those parts of the society that have been thrown under the bus. The uneducated children who are not given a superior education like we used to have. We are a society that is giving short shrift to the people that need us. I'm not saying that we ignore the health needs of our country. I'm saying that we ignore the mainstream media because they are not telling us the truth.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is about the size of it. That's why we urge you to turn to the progressive media. And here's this little reminder.
You don't really need to find out what's going on.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will not give you dirty laundry. We're going to give you the news. By the way, don't forget, you can get more of the details we wanted to get to you by going to averyvoice.com. 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 This news from Japan. A Japan physician says radiation levels were 100 times higher in Fukushima than the government reported even 50 days after 311. Geiger counters were completely off the scale at a train station 60 kilometers from the plant. Blatant concealment of data. Cesium is spiking in the ocean off the Fukushima plant. Record amounts for locations at 10,000 becquerels per square cubic meter. A former IAEA expert says fish have a real ability to accumulate cesium. The Shai Shimbun is reporting it's detected a rising level of radioactive cesium in seawater sampled at the mouth of the harbor. Combined 10 becquerels of cesium-134 and cesium-137 per liter. The level is the highest since the plant operator began sampling water in June at the mouth of the port, which marks the boundary between the harbor around the plant and the ocean. Samples taken a day earlier were below the measurable limits of 1.1 becquerels and 0.9 becquerels of cesium-137 per liter. The company said previous record amounts of radioactive cesium detected at the mouth of the harbor was 1.6 becquerels of cesium-134 and 4.7 becquerels of cesium-137. Fukushima farmer says that plutonium was detected all over his village 25 miles from the plant. From the NRDC, we further assume that cesium bioaccumulates in fish flesh such that the concentration of cesium in fish meat is 100 times the average concentration of cesium in the water where fish are swimming. Oceanus magazine says food's another pathway into the marine organism and in some cases the most important factor in uptake. Scott Fowler of Stony Brook University, after 30 years in the International Atomic Agency's Marine Environmental Library, said consumed radioisotopes are assimilated internally through the gut, potentially a far more efficient route than if they are absorbed externally from the environment. You can find a link on our site to Scott Fowler's presentation back in November. Last Sunday, October 6th, Sacramento Food Not Bombs was kicked out of the Cesar Chavez Park by Sacramento police. Volunteers were greeted by about 15 officers when they arrived at the park when they normally do time to normally share meals at 1:30. They were told their food would be confiscated and they would get summons due to an ordinance that has yet to even be passed that would prevent any group from handing out free hot meals in the park. Last week, advocates for the poor were told to stop sharing meals with the hungry in Sacramento and Santa Monica, Taos, New Mexico, and Olympia, Washington. Groups were confronted and threatened with arrest in Boulder, Raleigh, North Carolina, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, and other cities across the United States. In all, over 50 cities in the United States have passed laws banning or limiting the sharing of meals with the hungry in the past years, with enforcements on the increase this fall. Our food is vegan, organic, and no one has ever reported being made ill eating it, said Food Not Bombs. The goal of giving the public the impression that we're required to get a permit is justified, forcing us to stop. We have no paid staff. Our food is a gift and unregulated by the authorities. Like all acts of commission, no permission from the government is necessary. Please support Sacramento Food Not Bombs. Just do a search for foodnotbombs.net. And now, ladies and gentlemen, our first guest, Mr. Steve Horn, a journalist from Wisconsin, research fellow at the Smog Blog, and contributing editor at Counterpunch. Steve, welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
Sir, tell me, you've sent me some intriguing stories. Why don't you go ahead and start them off?
Sure. Well, I think the biggest environmental story of the past week that hasn't been talked about a whole lot in the mainstream media in particular, and really nowhere in particular, is except for on the Smog Blog, Reuters, and AP. But besides that, it's been pretty quiet. There's this huge spill that happened in North Dakota in the Bakken Shale Basin, literally the second biggest on-land oil spill in U.S. history that a few people have heard about, but it happened in the midst of the government shutdown, which is one of the big reasons why a lot of people haven't heard about it. It took over a week for it to be reported to the public, although officials in North Dakota knew about it and they kept it quiet for a while. It didn't come out to the public until a farmer in North Dakota contacted Reuters, and then the story kind of grew from there. I wrote, gave a little more context on the Slog blog, and now it's kind of become a little bit bigger of a story, but it's very troubling that the press is not allowed on the scene. There's private security on the scene, and the spill took place on the land that's a wheat farm, so we don't know if this toxic-laden, chemical-laden oil is affecting crops in any way. Actually, we don't really know the answers to a whole lot of questions. It's still all very murky. I haven't seen a single news story come out on it since my piece came out late last week, or late this week on Thursday.
Steve, let me ask you this. Do we know even, is it oil or is it dilbit?
It's not dilbit. Dilbit is tar sands, which would come from Alberta. This is oil that was fracked from North Dakota's shale, so it's not as thick, dense, and corrosive as that stuff that was well depicted in the spill in Mayflower, Arkansas in March of this year, but it's still pretty troubling because, as a lot of people know, this fracked oil and this fracked gas has a whole lot of, first of all, a lot of chemicals and may just still be stuck to it from the chemicals that were injected in the ground to get it to begin with, which are well known by people who follow fracking closely, things like benzene, et cetera. The list is long, but we don't know, and it's unclear whether or not when the samples will take place of what's actually in the ground right now in North Dakota on this land that's close to and on top of a wheat farm. We may not know for a while because the agency that's set to oversee spill management, the pipeline management and safety hazards administration, basically is furloughed right now and will become increasingly furloughed over time as the government shutdown continues. So that's the paradigm that we're dealing with for this second.
Steve, let me ask you this. When we saw the reporting on the Macondo blowout in the Gulf, the amount of oil changed almost daily from, just a little tiny bit to, maybe there was a little more, maybe there's a little more, until finally they admitted the massive amount of leak. And then we saw in Arkansas, the spill was basically declared a no-fly zone. The press was prohibited. Do you think this is the new way that the oil companies will be dealing with spills, by just basically locking the press out? Is that the solution they're discovering?
Well, that's the trend that we saw with BP. That's the trend we saw with ExxonMobil in Mayflower, Arkansas. And, again, it's happening again with this Tisero pipeline spill. So I think that it is the new trend, and it's especially worse now because not only is press not allowed, but because of the government shutdown, literally, the United States government is furloughed and can't go there at the federal level to see what's going on. So all we have is the North Dakota officials from the Department of Health and other state-level officials there. And North Dakota is the second biggest producer of oil in the United States. Their government is sadly very embedded with the industry, kind of like Texas, which is the biggest producer, and the whole process is corrupted, and the reason why we have a system of checks and balances, the federal government, the state government, is to ensure that, if one is acting in a way that's not in the interest of the public, but the other one checks it. It's just better for democracy. But when you have a government shutdown, that can't happen, and that's what's happening in North Dakota.
Well, you do you know what the original report? What is the report date again?
The original report of the spill was on September 29th. The public finally found out about it not until October 8th, so over a week later. And, that's another reason. The reason why it took so long, I mentioned people who can't clean up now, which is PHMSA, the federal agency that deals with spills. But then there's also the National Response Center, which is an arm of the Army Corps of Engineers, and they're also furloughed. And the part of their website that actually would give the public information about updates on the spill is actually down right now because of the government shutdown. So you really see the government shutdown in full effect for this bill, and it's another interesting and terrifying implication of the government being shut down in the age of especially increasing corporate power.
It's a shame it's not as important as, say, you know, the congressional gym.
Right, yeah, which is still open. I mean, you see a lot of things that aren't in particular helping people are still open. The Pentagon pretty much is still fully open. Many other, I mean, the list goes on. It's like the whole government shut down, but, you know, the EPA is, for example, shut down. These two agencies that I mentioned that deal with oil spills are shut down. The national parks are being shut down, except for, the case of oil drilling can still take place in the national parks. So you really see a trend of, you know, the government is good. The corporations like government when it helps their bottom line, but they hate government when it may, you know, regulate their activities and do things that would potentially hurt their bottom line a little bit, but help the public a lot.
Well, you know, you had another story you wanted to talk about. It follows along the same, oh, well, it's okay, we're just destroying the earth. You had a story about a former Obama official, is that correct?
I do, yeah. That was a story about Anita Dunn, and I've been writing about the story for pretty much the bulk of the past year, 2013.
Let me be flipped for a second. What has Anita Dunn?
Yeah, so Anita Dunn, the original story came up in the New York Times right before the 2012 election that she had, she's a former communications director for President Obama. The article was talking about how she was now an insider, outsider. So her first year in office, she served as Obama's communications director, and she also helped him get elected in 2008. She then went and worked for, and still works for the firm, Squire Dunn Knapp, or SDK Knickerbocker, or SKD Knickerbocker. And she, you know, she also basically is a lobbyist, unregistered. She's met with the White House. The record showed the New York Times article she met over 110 times in his first 4 years in office. And during that time, one of her key clients was TransCanada, which owns the Keystone XL pipeline. So she was pretty much not only doing PR for TransCanada, which my article was about. That article was about an ad that she did that said that the Keystone XL pipeline is good because of it gets the United States, very deceptive, it gets the United States off of foreign oil, Middle Eastern oil in conflict zone, and gets this ethical, quote, ethical oil from Canada and Alberta, the tar sands. But so she's doing the PR, but she's also doing a lot of lobbying as an unregistered lobbyist, basically meeting with Obama. And on top of that, her husband is a very important figure. He's Obama's personal attorney. His name is Robert Bauer, or Bob Bauer, and he also is a very influential attorney on election law, and unfortunately a big proponent of getting more corporate money into elections, kind of sort of like the Democratic Party's version of sort of like a Karl Rove of sorts, where he's really working on the inside to make super PACs more powerful, like Karl Rove's super PAC, Crossroads, GPS. So you really see that they're known in the D.C. press sort of as the power couple, as they like to say.
I'm sure that, wouldn't you agree that 350.org probably has the same kind of intimate regular visitor status with the White House, do you think?
Right, yeah, I'm sure that they got 110 visits. No, their visits were being arrested outside of the White House, as opposed to Dunn, who's inside of the White House pushing for that pipeline. It's just it's pretty insidious and sort of just the epitome of the revolving door in Washington, D.C.
Well, thanks so much, Steve. Let me bring on Frank Day, and he's going to give us his update from the panhandle of Florida. I've got more questions for you, so stick around, okay? Okay, here we go. Mr. Frank Day. Mr.
Yes.
Day.
Yes, sir. Good evening, Rick.
How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. Resting up from a whirlwind trip down to Pinellas County to Port Richey to work on the Amanda Murphy campaign yesterday.
How's that going?
Wonderfully. Wonderfully. I took a crew from myself and two gentlemen from Tallahassee and went down and engaged 280 Democrats yesterday, so they were all excited to get to, as the last gentleman stated, make sure his voice is heard on Tuesday.
Excellent, excellent. So you lucked out that last tropical storm. Hopefully, just gave you some sprinkles for your garden. But
that's about all we got, really. A light sprinkle. Fortunately for everyone on the Gulf Coast, the wind shears tore the top off of it when it was still 250-300 miles out, and basically just ripped it apart by the time it came ashore. It was just somewhat of a normal routine seasonal storm.
Well, that's good. What else is new up in the Panhandle for us? Frank, what can you tell us?
Well, it's new in the Panhandle. It's, of course, we just came off of county fair, Walton County Fair, and put in about 4 hours engaging the public there and answering questions on, of all subjects you would imagine, would be the national politics.
Sure.
Assuring folks that we would get through this regardless.
That's good. What's the buzz up there on the Affordable Care Act? Are people trying to sign up, or are they ignoring it? What do you hear?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we have an organization that is called PanCare, which is a healthcare facility organization of a group of three facilities in the Panhandle here that handles predominantly low income, but they will accept anyone with insurance as well, Medicare and standard insurance coverages as well. But with that organization, they have had three of their employees federally certified as navigators. So we're ready to answer questions on the Affordable Care Act for anyone wanting to sign up that needs help to get through the program.
That's great. That's great. You know, of course, there's all this controversy about, a Democratic big meeting coming up, and I guess it's toward the middle of the month. What are you hearing about potential candidates running for the Democratic governorship?
Well, there are hints, of course, that some in the Democratic Party are whispering that they expect Charlie Crist will announce his Democratic candidacy for governor during the state convention, which, by the way, is the weekend of the 25th, 6th, and 7th of October. We just have to wait and see on that. Of course, we know we have a fantastic candidate in Nan Rich, and she came over to the Panhandle for the Florida Democratic Women's Club annual conference convention in Panama City Beach, and as always, was well received by Panhandle Democrats.
Excellent, excellent. Now, obviously, there's a bit of conservative politics up there in the Panhandle, and I'm sure there's quite a bit of discussion about the shutdown and the sequester. What are you hearing from the proverbial man or woman in the street up there regarding the government shutdown and the sequester?
Well, what I'm hearing is, and I heard this and spoke to lots of Republicans, friends, and met new people as well, that sitting under the Democratic banner at our booth, of course, they wanted to ask questions, and quite a few. In fact, one former county commissioner had told me that he had switched from the Republican to the Democratic Party, and others are really and staunch Republicans, but individuals that still have their own mind and think freely, and have weighed the situation on the national scale with regards to the shutdown and the looming budget default, they're becoming a little bit more centrist, I think, and understanding in the national polls show, and as John McCain yet again confirmed this morning on Face the Nation, that, that their polls are so low, quote, we're down to blood relatives and paid staffers.
That was a good line. Whoever wrote that for him really needs to take a bow.
That's for sure. And believe it or not, the local Republican Party feels that as well. Some of the individuals, I say, not the party officials, of course. They have to they have their rules, as the Democratic Party does. They have to follow them. But there are members of the Republican Party that are intelligent people, and they see where this is going. And they truly understand that our life's first obligation is to the health and security of this country over politics.
You know, it strikes me as so odd that, you know, with everyone telling these people that they're going too far, that they're essentially going to be doing organizing for the Democrats if they continue this basically mindless policy, you just wonder what possesses them to think that this is a hell of a good idea.
Yes, I heard one question also, I think, was another question regarding Ted Cruz as having been suggested as led the Republican Party into a box canyon. And I think that's pretty much everybody is seeing this as happening and they're pulling away from that and ready to get this country moving again and headed toward prosperity.
We just heard from Steve Horn that with the shutdown, the oversight and the care for this oil spill up in North Dakota, the EPA and the Pipeline Authority is shut down. I'm glad to see that this piecemeal, let's bring back the pieces we like approach that the Republicans have taken is not getting any traction, or at least not much.
No, that's true. It's not getting much. Of course, you know, the hardliners are extremely busy blaming Democrats for not having accepted their deal on the front end. And I've had a bit of difficulty. A former Tea Party president here locally sends me emails and asks for my response to them periodically, and one of them, you know, he's been doing this for some time, and it's gotten to a point where I had to tell him, I said, look, I really can't allow this exchange between us to consume all my time, I says, but generally when I see an email, and it's obviously a chain email that's forwarded from one of the conservative think tanks, and I told him, I said, I generally look at these emails and try to find one good lie in it. And then I just let that push it in the toilet for me. And this particular one, let me think now, I had to answer it for two separate individuals. And I believe, the central question in it was, it's escaping me. Of course, one of those emails is blaming Democrats for the shutdown yet again. In this particular one, it was closing the all of the government shutdown, and then only opening those portions, closing those portions, and that the Republicans had funded or passed bills to fund everything that didn't have to do with administering Obamacare. And I just simply saw that one. I said, perhaps this is that one that does it for me in this email. I says, I would ask you to ask the national park workers that have been shut down, and in particular the one that made national news and Republicans have tried to get traction with, the World War II Museum, where the park workers have been furloughed. And I said, how do you square that when you push an email to all your people on your email list that has that glaring a lie, which the national media has already answered, basically?
Yeah, I signed up several years ago to a Tea Party mailer, and on one of my several email accounts, I don't get a chance to take a look at every one. God knows there's so many, almost as many as the Democratic Party asking for money. But I do look at least one or two every couple of days, and the vehemence and venom in those things is just it's remarkable. And you know, I think one of the positive things that's come from this, you know, kind of rampant outbreak of massive stupidity on their part is it gives people a pause to think about what rational, honorable disputation can be. You know, you can disagree with someone without making them an evil villain. Of course, I guess if you're Judge Scalia, they're part and parcel with the devil, I guess, because he sees the devil as so clever. But, yeah, you know, I just like I thought that Nixon gave us lots of good Democrats because of his excesses and Ronald Reagan the same thing. And God knows that George Bush did wonderful things for the Democrats. I suppose in kind of reverse jujitsu, we can say that we have Ted Cruz and Michelle Bachmann and their ilk to thank for making even Republicans reflect on what the loyal opposition is supposed to be about.
Yes. I look back at just, 7-8 months ago, Marco Rubio here in Florida, our senator from South Florida, was hailed as being the next savior. He had his face on one of the national being declared as the savior of the GOP. But, of course, he faded really quickly. And here you have Ted Cruz that seems to have followed the same. And, you know, I liken those guys nationally to our own Governor Rick Scott as having been the Democratic Party's best recruiter. By instituting policies and support that hurt Floridians to the point that those good Democrats you described face themselves with a question: if not now, when? If not now, when? Kind of choice, and just have to get up off of their recliners, out of their routine, and become active and try to change policy.
Let me ask you a question. You know, you live among a very conservative area. I do too. And, you know, you talk to lots of people. Do you think that this Tea Party run off the pier or run off a cliff, are these people are going to be handed the Republican Party's presidential nomination reins? Do you think that this is what we have to look forward to in 2016?
I don't think so. I think the majority in the Republican Party, and I saw this in the attitudes that I had from conversations with Walton County Republicans, moderate Republicans, this past week. And I think they're ready to pull their party back out of the gutter, out of the ditch with the Tea Party, basically, and pull closer back to their core values that we all should be seeking, I think, and that's respect of one another and straight and foremost, honesty.
Let me ask you a question about our illustrious governor here of Florida. He seems to have been taking a mighty low-key approach to things lately. You can hardly see him anywhere. I would expect he'd be out there touting his alternative to the Obama plan, if there actually was one. What do you think's up with a good governor?
I can't really speak for the governor other than just to speculate that perhaps he's comfortable with his campaign war chest. Of course, with the recent, I believe it was the recent Supreme Court decision that allows individuals now to double or double their campaign contributions as it for individuals now, not just for corporations. So he should be sitting pretty with regard to that. So I would suspect that's probably why he's being a bit low-key. And, you know, another option is also to as a possibility, pretty much out of sight, out of mind, you're also not a target. So maybe he's just trying to let all this national negative publicity go on by over his head and not get caught up in it.
That's probably a pretty good analysis. Do you think there's going to be a a Democratic Party primary here in Florida, gubernatorial-wise?
I think so. I think they will. I surely think they will. I've had Republican friends that have lamented or voiced jealousy, basically, or envy, probably the more appropriate word, of the Democratic Party for our internal party politics in the past, of everybody coming together to elect leaders and to support those leaders. When you see situations, well, in our local county party, when they'll have five or six candidates for the same county commission seat, and then really it just gets vicious. Same with statewide politics, and as we've seen national politics, their party has put many candidates out for the presidential campaign in the primary season, and they're doing us a great service in doing so. And but I do see a second candidate announcing, and there will, in my opinion, I feel like that there is going to be a Democratic primary for governor.
Did your supervisor elections up there go through and find just lots and lots of illegal alien voters up there?
I don't think he has. It hadn't made the press. But I will be filing a public records request, though, to see just what, if any, names he has purged from the rolls, so that I can comb through those and verify that they, if he has pulled any names off the polls, are legitimate.
Excellent. Excellent. Frank, is there any other issue up there we should be aware of up in the panhandle?
Well, yes. Of course, we're working hard. Panhandle Democrats are to expose the efforts of our representatives, Steve Sullivan, for the 2nd Congressional District, for signing letters giving away basically the votes of constituents in Congressional District 2 to representatives who have ideals that they want everyone to support from other states. I had discussions on that issue as well. Our 1st Congressional District Representative Jeff Miller has done the same exact thing. In one of the cases, I believe it's the junior senator from Western North Carolina, I think at 8 months in from the 2012 election, had written a letter that seemed to have gotten wide appeal. Jeff Miller signed it up front, and then hastily pulled his name out after the fact, I think wondering that potentially that could be used against him. But this latest letter, and I forget, Representative Ribble, I believe was his name, and I want to think from Wisconsin, had written a letter, and 50 of the Tea Party Republican representatives had quickly and hastily signed on to that one. So both our panhandle congressmen, signatures are on that letter. So we have, and the constituents in both 1st and 2nd congressional districts, in my opinion, should have a bone to pick with their representatives having given their votes away.
Excellent. Excellent. A story that hasn't gotten much play here. Another issue up that way, I think, is do you folks have a nuclear plant up there? Or is
over
that Crystal
Bellamo
River?
City, yes. One that's about, I'd say, been in operation some over 30 years that I'm aware of. But in the local media, it's always referred to as the steam plant, not the nuclear power plant. Yes, it produces steam. That's about what you see from it. So that's how they refer to it, not as a nuclear power plant, but as the steam plant.
Are the good people of that region called upon to invest in nuclear power's improvements, whether or not they plan on building it, like the people at Crystal River are?
I don't think so. I believe that one's restricted to Florida Power and Light, is it not? And of course, we're under Gulf Power. Most all of our power comes out of the subsidiaries of Alabama Power, the Southern Group, in general, which that's just an offshoot conglomeration of Alabama Power, I believe. But anyway, literally an extension of a term we've always been referred to as Lower Alabama in the Panhandle anyway. But that's predominantly where we, and most of it is hydroelectric generation or gas generation. We have the Crampton Farley Nuclear Power Plant that was built in the mid-late 70s. That's in Dothan, Alabama, just out of Dothan, Alabama. So not a great number of nuclear power plants out there. And from what I understand, there are none on the drawing board nationally for a good while now.
Are you folks seeing fracking up your way or not yet?
Are we what now?
Fracking?
I don't know. I haven't heard any talk about the effects of fracking locally. We haven't seen oil drilling. Of course, there was the bill that had proposed to have oil drilling off the coast of the Panhandle. And back in 2011, I believe, late term, the Florida House had passed a measure that fortunately the Republican Senate chose to hold off and not look at that one that close to the end of the cycle. And it died. But that one would have allowed local county commissions to have issued permits to allow gas and oil transmission right across the beaches, the world's most beautiful beaches, and right here in South Walton County.
Frank, let me ask you a question. You've been involved in Democratic politics for a long time. What was it early in your life that made you be a person who tries to help, who works on building a better society? What in your early experiences guided you to this kind of work?
Well, remembering back in the 60s, segregation, and how I grew up in South Alabama, a little town called Op, Alabama, and watching how that played out on the news as a kid, you know, you don't really pay that close attention to the news, but it caught my eye, and I guess early on, of course, our school was one of the last, our county was one of the last in the country to desegregate, and the spring before desegregation occurred, our superintendent of schools called an assembly and passed out school choice forms as a further effort to ensure that Covington County, Alabama schools were desegregated by having white kids fill out all the positions first in white schools. And he was almost successful that first year of desegregation. There were only four kids came to our school. And I have to say, as eighth graders entering that for the very first time, I can still to this day remember the expression of fear in those four kids' faces. And that's where I began to wake up. I was raised in the racist South, South Alabama, and had literally hadn't had a conversation with a black person at that point until desegregation, and we had classmates suddenly. And so it was an eye-opener for me. Then I've joined the Army at the age of 17, and there again worked day in and day out with African Americans and just began to look at how the history played out with desegregation, watching the news scene and footage of how they were beaten, fire hosed, and just thinking, no, that could have been me, but for my skin color.
Yeah.
And you know, it's an ugly scar on the history of this nation for sure.
Well, thanks a lot. I hope you can stand by. I'm going to bring on Gwen Holden Berry, and hopefully you can stick around and participate in our roundtable at the half hour. So let me bring on Gwen Holden Berry. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
Gwen, welcome.
Thank you, Rick. Good evening. How are you?
Very good, very good. I have to ask you, since unfortunately I'm usually tied up in my prep, what was your show on tonight? Gwen has a show on just before me from 6 to 7. Gwen, what was the theme of your show tonight?
Well, it was the same thing I brought to the table here. It's the question of the Nobel Prizes and how valuable they are to the human community right now, what their real motivation has become. In the question of the young girl from Pakistan, Malala, who who the internet activist community is either madly passionately for winning it or being over, or the other half saying that she's a dupe and a pawn of the war machine at a corporate level, especially from the Western America, since all of this has happened to her. It's huge.
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting story, and you know, no one who believes in human rights can't be touched by someone who is reaching out for education. But as you suggest, there have been some stories in the progressive media about some interesting threads that tie her family and certain internationalist groups and point to curious missing data on how this all happened. Can I ask you, have you come to a conclusion, or are you still collecting data?
Well, I'm still trying to do the due diligence, if you will, but I'm going to suggest to you, and I think it's going to balk most of your journalists here, but the thing is that we have so much information. There's such a deluge, especially from the net, and a lot of wonderful information and valid information comes out of especially the very serious activist nets out there that are, you know, putting information up and posting all the time. So it's kind of impossible to get it all down. But I will say this. I think that oftentimes we have to feel it out for ourselves.
Sure.
And from a personal point of view here, I think that Malala is a brave, an intrepid young woman who has stood up to the most fearful thing you can stand up to. The young girl was shot in the face. Now, people are questioning the validity of that and saying, well, we saw pictures of this, and then we saw her walking across the tarmac while other people said that she was whisked off in the Emir's jet, via all kinds of hookups and IVs and barely living and stuff. You know, you don't know. This is the interesting part about this, Rick, is we don't know who to believe anymore, do we?
Nope.
We don't completely believe the mainstream media, if we're critically thinking, anymore. And at the same time, the compelling and sincere nature in which she presents herself to the face of the camera, often very nervous, and the message, I go to the message. What is the message that this young woman, child, is putting to the face of humanity in the moment? And her message is clearly about women taking a leadership role on this planet through educating themselves and standing up to the injustice against women and saying, okay, enough's enough. And it's coming from what I think is probably a very healthy Islam base in her family. And I'm not talking about the Taliban or who everybody seems to get afraid of. I'm talking about the very nurturing and beneficent side of Islam that's out there in the majority of the world. And this young girl is standing in front of the face of the world right now after being shot, going through all of this. And so large groups of media manipulators and representation and all of that have come at her father. And what is she to do? Is she to back away and say, that's not integritous for me? No, she is doing her best, I think, personally, to navigate these very difficult waters, to listen to who she thinks her elders are telling her the best stuff, the best intentions to do. Yeah, I think she's valid. I think she's credible. I think she also could be being manipulated. I think in the end, she will have the last word because she has a strength that we rarely see. And that's obvious by where she's come from and where she's risen to. This is a little girl, Rick, who stood up and questioned, why can't I learn more? Why can't I be a doctor? Why can't I be like the last woman who led Pakistan? course, absolutely, we don't want her to be assassinated. But, and so the clarity here is that why are we worrying about the agendas of agents behind her you know, booking? And is she a stooge? I don't think so. I think what we really have to keep in mind here and take a look at is the message that this young girl is bringing to the face of humanity right now. And, of course, there's going to be extreme polarity. And, again, I will come back to what I think we really have to do, which is sometimes we just have to feel out the news, what is truthful and what is not truthful. And sometimes we're going to get sideways by it. But you know what? I think definitely I don't think there's anybody sitting here with us tonight who wouldn't say that they understand just instinctually what is right and what is wrong. And this young lady feels right to me.
Uh-huh. I agree. I have the same feeling. You know, and you weigh things like, on the one hand, the Taliban is a creature of the CIA and the Pakistani intelligence. And on the other hand, we know for a fact that women's schools are under attack. So it's hard to parse this all out. And obviously, are there hidden hands? Yeah, I think you can probably much guess that. But on the other hand, you know, the common honesty, the simple cry for a person who wants to be educated, you can't go wrong.
Well,
if I can ask,
you know,
go ahead.
Well, I. It brings into question to the actual agenda of the Nobel Committee. It opens corporate doors and puts money on the table for people. And I think in the last 10 years or so, we've watched that go from being, I mean, when I was in college, wow, who's got the Nobel this year? And the woman in Canada who won for literature, oh, bravo, because it's wonderful. Still, I question now whether the Nobel Prize is nothing but a manipulation tool for agendas that have that kind of money, that they sway that kind of, you know. I mean, listen to who you were playing a clip from earlier here, Miss Karen Hughes, that the World Bank whistleblower. And she's saying it. She's saying, you know, folks, we are being manipulated here. I mean, you know, you just walk across the street to talk to the other person about what kind of wage slavery they're involved in, you know.
Sure.
That's what's going down right now, basically. And so, like I said, you really do. You have to feel a lot of it out. And use your due diligence the best you can. I mean,
Gwen,
independence, yeah.
Let me ask you to hold there. I want to bring on our next guest. Right. Hopefully you can stick around for our round robin at the half hour. Let me bring on Mr. Hans Meyer. Hans, welcome.
Good evening, Rick. How are you tonight?
Very good, sir. Very good. I know you brought some interesting subjects to the table. Lay them out, sir.
Yeah, I have a little rant. You know, years ago, Congress passed a law that basically allowed individuals to sign up for a do-not-call list, okay? In other words, I'm tired of being harassed by, solicitors and whatnot on my phone. So when my wife and I availed ourselves of that several years ago, and recently we renewed both our home phone as well as our cell phone. Now, that does not stop the obnoxious telecallers, especially those, and you know, we have caller IDs, so I can easily see who's calling, and a quick Google pretty much indicates that they're scammers, okay? So we just ignore those calls. Now, a couple of weeks ago, at 7:13 p.m., and that's an important time to note as I continue on with my little story here, 7:13 p.m., we get a call, and the the caller ID pops up and it says private, which means that whoever's calling is masking or blocking their name and masking or blocking their phone number. Fine, okay, we're not going to answer that call. We go on through our evening, we go to bed, and the next morning I get up and I notice on my phone in my office, it's blinking that there's a voicemail there. Oh, okay. So I pick up the phone and I punch the numbers that allow me to review the calls. And sure enough, it says we have one voicemail from 7:13 p.m. And it goes on to say that the caller has refused to give their name or phone number. Okay, knew that. Then the message begins. It's Steve Sutherland in his own voice calling, saying this and that and the other, and we've gotten your voicemail, and we'll call back again. Well, Rick, I understand that there's probably some loophole, something that allows politicians to ignore the do not call list. Number one, I would think that a, quote, small government, quote, you know, get out of my life is a government politician, A, would at least abide by the do not call list, at least the spirit of the do not call list.
Sure.
Apparently not Steve Sutherland. Secondly, 7:13 p.m. Now, my wife and I do not have children. We generally eat a little bit later on, but what are most people doing between, say, 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. in the evening? They're having their dinner, their time with their family. The last thing they want to do is be interrupted. Next, why is it that the congressman who represents my district is masking or hiding his phone number behind the caller refused to give their name and phone number? Excuse me? You're calling and interrupting me during dinner hour, and you're not even giving me the courtesy of telling me through both the caller ID as well as the voicemail who you are? And finally, and this is really the cake, who's paying for this, Congressman Sutherland? Are you paying for this out of your own pocket? Is your campaign paying for this? I don't think so, because the gist of his message indicated that he was calling on official congressional business, which leads me to believe that my tax dollars are paying for him to call and interrupt me without announcing who you are. You're interrupting me in my home. And I find that from Mr. Small Government Conservative Steve Sutherland, I find that, you know, rude, obnoxious, and quite frankly, incomprehensible. I'll get off my soapbox now, Rick.
It sounds like a real man of the people, huh?
You know, and when you look at the, I got to tell you, he is stereotypical of the teabagger mentality, the keep your government hands off my Medicare, small government republicanism here, because quite frankly, oh, they're all in favor of that except when it interferes with what they want to do, including interrupting Hans and Susan Meyer in our home over our telephone when we've asked not to be interrupted, when we've asked to not have those kind of calls come in. But it's just typical, which is why, quite frankly, I'm supporting and will work diligently for former governor and U.S. Senator Bob Graham's daughter, Gwen Graham, in her campaign for congressman for the 2nd Congressional District of Florida.
Excellent. And your other story, sir?
Well, other than my little rant there, we do have coming up. I'm a member of the Capital Tiger Bay Club here in Tallahassee, which is a truly a nonpartisan a humor-driven political organization. We like to insult all sides, left and right, Republican and Democratic, equally. But we have Charlie Pierce coming up for our annual Tiger at Bay, which is our big yearly blowout, if you will. And for those who are not familiar, Charlie Pierce is on NPR. I believe it is, wait, don't tell me, that he's on. But he's also written a book, the gist of which is, when did America become the land of the imbeciles? And I'm going to tell you, I'm anxious and looking forward to hearing what he has to say, and I'll be happy to follow up with a report from that, that particular meeting. So,
We look forward to hearing that from you. I wanted to raise a couple questions with the group, and I think this is a good time to go ahead and start that process. Many of us are concerned about the issues raised by the NSA and their absolute hoovering of all electronic communications, and they keep having to recharacterize their monitoring, recording, and storing this information as simply the metadata, even though that's had to be revised again and again and again. And some of us are also aware that the commercial interests that we all engage in, whether to go buy our groceries or order our prescriptions or transact business through the online vendors of e-commerce that are so popular these days, we know how much information we have to give away basically to live our lives. And I'm beginning to sense that there is a increasing bit of, let's say, the best way to put this, reluctance and feedback that this is not the way to go. And I was wondering how you people are feeling about this this constant monitoring.
Well, if I may interject here, I'm sort of in many respects very philosophical about that. I remember discussing this with one of my friends not too long ago, and I pointed out to him that if they, whoever they may be, have it in for you and they're bugging your phone, for example, they've already got it in for you. And all they're doing now at this particular point in time is simply finding the appropriate whatever to take you to court or to arrest you or whatever the case may be. Now, I don't mean to be overly simplistic on that, but the truth of the matter is we do live in an age where, whether we like it or not, that's just the way things are now. I don't like it. I like privacy as much as the next guy. But, unless you're willing to hole yourself up in a cabin out in the middle of nowhere and pulling the plug on everything that has come before us, all of the technology and the communication and whatnot, I don't like it. But yet, what are we going to do about it? We cannot turn the clock back. We cannot all of a sudden say, okay, nope, we're not going to have any Big Brother whatsoever, because quite frankly, I go to Publix, I go to CVS, I go to Whole Foods, I go to Disney World, I go to anywhere. They're collecting information. They're making your life easier for you. I Google something. Well, all of a sudden, here are some suggestions. Oh, and based upon your Google, you might be interested in this or that. How do you turn that off? You either accept the fact that that's the way it is today, or you bury your head in the sand and wish it weren't. Well, That's the way it is. And again, I don't like the invasion of privacy. Who does? But yet, that's sort of the way it is. And I'm reminded of the movie Inherit the Wind, which was Spencer Tracy and Frederick.
Right,
Clark.
Right. Know it well. I know it well.
Okay, and there was a monologue at that in which the Henry Drummond character portrayed by Spencer Tracy talks about at one time we thought about the birds and what have you. Well now we have the ability to fly, and yet the skies smell of gasoline. We at one time we had the romance of distance, and now we have the telephone, which removed that. Well, you know, and he lists a number of things along those lines. Well, you know, again, I'm philosophical about it. We can't undo it. We can't go back. Do I want Big Brother looking in on me? No. Nobody does. But how do we stop it? And furthermore, how do we stop it, especially when there are bad people out there in this world that do mean us harm? I don't know. I'm a very conflicted person on this.
No, I can appreciate that. You make a good point. I'm going to dig into that in a minute, but I'm going to go ahead and bring on Rob Abstin, who has his couple stories to bring on. Then we'll go back to the round table. Everybody prepare your answers, and we'll be back in just a few minutes for that. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Rob Abstin, of Executive Director of Plan, and also host of Smile, It's Only Politics. Rob, welcome.
Hey, Rick, I don't know. I want to make sure you can hear me before I start off on this.
Oh, I hear
rant.
You fine, sir. Hear you fine.
Okay, great. You touched on a number of things that I wanted to talk about. And I want to start out, though, by quoting a very well-known quote that everybody has probably heard a gazillion times in their lifetime, and that is, I have a dream. I have a dream, and I suspect you have a dream, and I think every one of the members of your panel tonight has a dream. And what that dream really is vision. And, you know, I don't typically go around making points by quoting the Bible, but in this case, I'm going to. And there is a verse in Proverbs that says that without vision, the people die. And when Dr. Martin Luther King said, I have a dream, what he was really saying is, I have a vision. I have a vision of the future. And that's what PLAN is about, the Progressive Leadership Action Network. And it's been a pleasure working on our book project with you, Rick, as a part of the Progressive Leadership Action Network effort.
Thanks, sir.
A little over a year ago. But this point that you were just making about the constant monitoring and that Hans so eloquently spoke to is a very good example of what is wrong with America and why we felt the need to produce this book called Fix America. When I first met you a couple of years ago when I came back to Florida from a sojourn up in Quebec, you and I sat down at a sandwich shop and had a long conversation about the media and about activism and about the need for the two to interact. And this issue of constant surveillance is one of those things that is distressing not just the progressive community, but even more broadly all of America, even though there may be some cognitive dissonance about what the cause of it is and who is to blame for it. But we see that not just, as Hans said, when you go to Disney World or when you go shopping at Publix, but even when you're just driving down the road and you've got these traffic cams set up at red lights, and they've got your, of course, the turnpike as well, which is how they send you the bill if you don't pay the toll. But there's a more insidious side of all of these cameras that are pointing at us, and that is that in the wrong hands, that kind of information can really be a terrible evil to a society.
And if I may, exactly what you're talking about is a concept called panopticism. Fuqua actually wrote about this more than 100 years ago. You go back prior to the French Revolution, and you look at the penal system, and you had prisons that, in order to monitor the prisoners, a guard would have to literally walk by each door and look in to see if the prisoner was behaving him or herself or not. So the realizing that that's, you know, as the prison population was exploding, that was no way to be able to manage large number of prisoners. So the idea was adopted that you had all of the cells overlooking a central guard tower. And so because you couldn't have one guard for each cell, you would have a small number of guards overlooking a huge number of cells, but each prisoner within each cell would not know at any given time whether he or she was being observed. Consequently, their behavior was such that they behaved themselves because they didn't know whether they were or not. Now, let's fast forward. You mentioned the red light cameras, for example. Since their introduction, I will admit that I am the same way. I know exactly where the red light cameras are in this town and which intersections they're located at. And yet, my behavior is now modified that I don't run any red light. I don't try to make it. And in fact, if there's any doubt, I will stop, even if it was yellow and I had enough time to get through. That's behavior modification. That's panopticism, because you just don't know when you are or not. And take a look at any of these stories about Walmart and parents or guardians taking liberties, if you will, with their children in the parking lot of Walmart that end up on YouTube and the evening news. And oh, how horrible it is. And yet the fact remains that we, as especially American people, are modifying our behaviors because of the constant presence of the surveillance.
You know,
that's true.
I think,
and you know, we applaud that kind of monitoring when it helps us to catch the thief or the kidnapper or somebody who's trying to get away, and we catch them on the webcams and we track them down and we find them. And, you know, it's not that the webcams are good or bad. It's how they're used. And that's where the big issue comes in. And I'm sorry I wanted to jump in there, but go ahead, Rick, and then I'll come back with
I was just going to say, the point I was getting at is, yes, there is a certain facilitation of e-commerce that happens because they have all of this information. Yes, subset of humanity that you might call terrorists who are a real threat to this country might be a hundredth of 1% of humanity. I think that the question that is brought up that really comes to play is how much are we giving up for how much protection? And while I'm as prepared as many to regard the Obama administration as not quite akin to Stalin, I am concerned that as this becomes the standard, that we have all of our commercial and corporate and as well as interpersonal relations constantly monitored by an increasingly psycho-sophisticated database system, that if we don't pull in the reins now, we have gone down a slope to call slippery, I think, is an understatement. So I'm going to go ahead and re-ask you, Gwen,
Rick, if I may post it on that, I think we've already gone beyond that. I think it's already too late.
Yeah, but
I really hate to be pessimistic about it, But the means and the wherewithal to monitor everyone's comings and goings is already there. I think the genie is out of the bottle, and there's just no way we're ever going to put it back.
Go ahead, Gwen.
I think you have to learn to navigate, but the water, as it were. But there are certain places there that it's also a freedom of speech and a freedom of artistic expression that begins to come into play when you want to clamp down on just how much we're giving and trading and learning from one another and how free the nets are with information going back and forth. But I know I'm going out of the ballpark a bit there, but, you know, we have to, right now, I think what we really need to do is join and support the ACLU and work to reverse some of this with the NSA. If you don't want them to know, though, it's like the gentleman said, you really need to live right the heck off the grid, and that means no banking either. You know, cash your checks at the grocery store. The ease of lifestyle that technology is providing us is building us a planetary mind, a planetary consciousness where we all, I mean, I have friends in Japan and Tehran and all over in Pakistan because of this technology that I talk face-to-face with via Skype. I mean, that's pretty cool. That is pretty cool. And it's building
Gwen,
in a unique
just
way.
Just one thing I would say, you can't cash your check at the grocery store because they take your fingerprints.
You're right. You're right. I've forgotten that. They started that. I don't do it anymore, but I did for years when I lived in Massachusetts.
And of course, to facilitate direct deposit, you have to give the employer or the contractee access to both deposit and withdraw from your account.
That's why entrepreneurs are the way to go. The wave of the future is making a living for yourself, I guess. But I'm being sort of jovial there. I realize that. Still,
and Gwen, you know, in many respects you're right, but you know, again, I hate to be just sort of hang it up, but
go ahead.
We've gone beyond all that. To be off the grid today in America, you can't do it. You literally cannot do it.
You're at the bottom rung of
society, where you're poor. You have a two pennies to rub together. You're still going to have some kind of assistance.
Well, quality of life is not always determined by what you're bringing home monetarily.
But Gwen, it's not a matter of quality of life. It's a matter of the fact that the society we live in today, you cannot be off the grid. Quality of life, no quality of life. Lots of money, no money. You can't go from point A to point B in this country today. Unless you have literally nothing, but even then,
Hold on. Let me get Frank in here. Frank, do you have a thought on this, sir?
Yes, I do. I was just in the background listening. Everyone's made some wonderful comments. With regard to the NSA, we may be too far down that slippery slope there. It being the government, what can we do there at any rate? But with regard to the corporate gathering or businesses gathering information on us and building databases, I'm curious, and of course I'm no attorney on this, but I'm just curious if potentially we couldn't copyright our images, our likeness, fingerprints, and even our DNA and gain some control like that. If Monsanto can copyright the genetic code of all of our food crops in the world, and then determine who gets to plant it at what price, cannot we then copyright our own personal information?
I think you're raising a good point.
And bravo to that idea.
It's a great idea.
But get everybody in your neighborhood to do that. Then get everyone in your community to do that. Then get everyone in your county to do that, and everyone in your state to do that, and everyone in this country to do that. And just going beyond your neighborhood, you can see what a futile effort it would be.
Well, let's
again, I
hold
hate
on
to
there.
Be the pessimist here.
Oh, that's okay. But let me go ahead and raise a second question, because that question, as abstract as it might seem initially, I have some very interesting points that I want to bring up in relative to that universal that universal database that we all live in. A story just recently by Kevin Gonstallo raises this issue. Police in North Carolina have been engaging in spying to root out the anarchists in the Moral Monday protests. For those who are not aware of the Moral Monday protests, many people in the Carolinas, North Carolina, have been so concerned about the rightward drift of the Tea Party in charge of the legislature there, they've been calling together people to come and pray at the legislature and have raised the issue. They're calling it Moral Monday. We have to care for the sick. We have to care for the poor. We have to care about our children. So this protest, this regular Monday protest, has been called Moral Mondays. And they've been arrested, just like the people in Wisconsin. I was hoping to have Steve on here for this, but unfortunately he's having trouble getting back in. But the reason I bring this up is that we've seen that this is not an innocuous, oh, we're only looking at Islamic terrorists. We have found the Quakers in Lake Worth called out as terrorists. We've seen here we've got people coming together to pray for Moral Mondays being designated as anarchists and terrorists. Individuals who engaged in civil disobedience during Moral Monday protests are on trial in North Carolina. During the first trial of one of these protesters, it came out in testimony that the police of the state's legislature were conducting undercover surveillance and collecting intelligence on, quote, anarchists. Not many anarchists I know pray. Moral Monday protests were organized throughout the summer by North Carolina's chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Held to challenge a Republican legislature who's rejected federal funds for Medicaid that could have helped 500,000 poor people, promoted policies to defund public education, cut tax credits for hundreds of thousands of poor and working people, while giving tax breaks to the wealthiest people in the state. They've rolled back environmental protections, increased the limits on a woman's right to choose an abortion, and for introducing voter suppression laws on April 4th. General Assembly Police Chief Jeff Weber told a district court, according to the Charlotte Observer, there were people in the region that they considered to be anarchists and had collected intelligence on them. He did not identify who these anarchists were, how many individuals in his department had been labeled anarchists because officers considered them to be against the government. He did admit that more than 930 individuals arrested during the summer. His officers had scanned the many Moral Monday rallies with eyes trained for anarchists. Now, you link that up with the fact that they've arrested people at the Republican convention in Minneapolis before they protested because they were guilty of the thought crime of planning to exercise their right to dissent. So I'm afraid that this is not something that we can blithely ignore. And granted, Hans, it would be difficult to have everyone behave thoughtfully and conduct themselves in a way that they might regain some of those. But unless those of us who are aware of these things begin to raise the issue, I'm afraid that the rest of us are all going to go down in one slick gulp.
Yeah, but so, Rick, one point here. You're talking about a very well-established, purely American position. You go back to the First World War and immediately following. And what you just said about anarchists was exactly what was used by the government to go after so-called
anarchists and labor organizers
and
foreigners.
During the 1930s. You look at before the Second World War and following, and especially during the McCarthy era. And you go all the way up through George Walker Bush, who talked about you're either with us or against us. It's a grand American tradition you're talking about.
Well, granted. Let somebody else have a chance to talk.
During the Mayday riots.
The room.
Go ahead, Rob.
For this,
I was just going to say, go back to 1886 during the May Day riots when the anarchists were blamed for the labor unions were blamed as being a bunch of anarchists. If you read about Mary Harris, Mother Jones, Mary Harris Jones, and her stories about how the anarchists were joining the labor unions in their efforts to protect the immigrants and the minorities that were coming in. And so the labor bosses were blaming the labor unions for being anarchists just because they happened to both be defending the immigrants. And so it's you're absolutely right, Hans. This is a proud tradition for over 200 years.
Gwen, you were having a comment to make. I'm sorry.
You know, the thing is that basically this history repeating itself is quite true. However, the factors are a bit different now. It's not World War One. It's not, you know, mid-industrialization. It's right now we're looking at the empire crumbling on an economic scale globally, and we're also looking at the destruction of the resources that it takes to create the war that funds all of the different economies. We are looking at
shutdown. I don't think the empire is crumbling. I think it's like you said, Gwen, it's history repeating itself. If you've read Kevin Phillips' book, Wealth and Democracy, you'll see that what's actually happening is that we are transitioning out of being the global power, and that global power status is being transitioned to the next place. It came from England to the United States. It came from Spain to England. It came from the Dutch to Spain. And it's a manipulation that's been taking place for 400 years.
You're not taking into consideration the abundance of people on this planet, the destruction of the seas, and my God, Fukushima. Does anybody think about Fukushima right now while we're talking, and what's going on right now with our environment, our atmosphere, and our ocean? We're being mutated in the moment by radiation.
Yeah, but Gwen, and here's the fun part of that. About
and that's
that.
Not,
it's,
that's
it's
not
sort of
me
a,
being
it's
dramatic.
Sort of an extension. It's sort of an extension of NIMBY. It's not happening in my backyard, so it's not happening.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I do see what you're saying.
You know, it's sad, and it's just like you look at the inequality of salaries and income in this country. My Lord, the French had this down pat 250 some years ago, and they let them all off to the guillotine. Today, because we have been so conditioned to we're only one lottery draw away from being amongst the wealthy, or the American dream will come true for me tomorrow, so I'm not going to say anything bad about the wealthy, et cetera, et cetera.
He's
so
right.
We all cower. We're all afraid. We all sit here in our own little terrified environment.
We're greedy.
Afraid to lose our house, our power, our on and on and on.
Yeah.
And that's exactly where they want us to be. So let me
go ahead and bring Frank back in.
Who cares,
Frank?
That the Japanese are poisoning their water, and who cares that they're starving people down the street? Just don't rock my little world here.
My
okay,
gosh,
hold on, Frank.
Well, I mean,
yes, you have a question.
Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, you had a question?
Well, what I was going to say is, you know, you live in a very conservative area. I'm sure it's not that difficult for the police up there to keep track on who goes to rallies, who goes to protests. Do you see that kind of attention to dissenting voices up there from the local police?
I don't know if I could put that into the local police. We have three municipalities in our vast county to begin with. So the great majority of our county is unincorporated, so controlled by a sheriff's department. I just don't see the manpower or the money available to do that kind of tracking. Who goes to the rallies? Yes, but that's done from the political side, from the Republican versus the Democratic side. Now, being the head of the Democratic Party, I don't know of any of our members. I know I have not been in any discussions with our party leaders where there was any discussion at all about reporting on who's meeting. As individuals, yes, but not with regard to their political politics or anything like that. I don't see it being done in law enforcement.
Okay. Let me ask
Frank, don't you have everybody.
Eglin
Air Force Base? Don't you have Eglin Air Force Base up there in Walton County?
Yeah. Yes, we're surrounded by, I believe, five military bases right here in the central and western panhandle.
So there's plenty of eyes on everybody if anything really got out of hand.
A funny occurrence that happened with some testing at Eglin Air Force Base with some of their radio systems a while back, where they discovered that the frequencies that they were using was randomly opening and closing people's garage doors. So when they would test those radios, they got to a point where they would inform the public ahead of time that they would be doing it and their garage doors would be opening.
Yeah, I probably worked on some of those systems when I worked up there at TASC up in Fort Walton.
Yeah.
Okay, let me raise one last question that we can go around quickly on. You know, fracking is impacting more and more water supplies. Obviously, for those of us who pay attention to the non-existent news on Fukushima and keep an eye on that, I want to ask you this. Have you made changes in your purchasing habits regarding whether it be danger to your water supply or your concerns about the impact on the Pacific Ocean? Have you made changes as of now? And let me just go right through the list. Frank, let me ask you first.
Yes, my wife and I routinely drink green tea that's imported from Japan. Right away, when Fukushima hit the news, we went around to the local Asian store and bought up all the existing supply so that we had enough to get through any potential period where some that was contaminated with radioactivity might hit the market. Yeah, that didn't happen. As it turned out, we overreacted in the beginning that tea is grown in so many different areas, China, India, various other places, and they all have green tea. So it was really a non-starter. Initially, though, we did make that purchasing change to pick that up. With regard to fracking, though, and with the governor's defunding of our wildlife and waterways, I have been actively working. I'd encourage everyone on this panel as well to look up your local activists that are volunteering with the Florida Water and Land Legacy. That's one of the things, and that's a coalition of various environmental groups that's got petitions, constitutional amendment on the ballot, take politics out of funding for those natural resources that we're talking
Thank
about.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Hans, how about you, sir? Have you made any changes in your buying, given some of these environmental concerns?
Yes, but more importantly, you know, and this is the great frustration. It wasn't too long ago. I remember there was some Republican member of either the Senate or the House talking about how some change in our energy policies would take 30 years to implement. Well, more than 30 years ago, we had leadership in this country that talked about the energy crisis in this country is a matter of national security. And if we don't act today, it's going to affect us and our children. And that national leadership was Jimmy Carter. And that 30 years clock started when he gave that so-called malaise speech in 1980, I believe it was. And here we are 33 years later, and we're still talking about, we're wringing our hands. What are we going to do about the energy crisis, and how are we going to cut back, and et cetera, et cetera. That 30-year clock is eligible to start at any point that we have the leadership and the guts to do so. And Jimmy Carter gave us that example 33 years ago. Why don't we start it today? And in answer to your question, yes. We all do what we can, but we also go there and we fill up with that $3.25 a gallon gasoline because what else are we going to do?
Thanks so much. Gwen, how about you?
Well, I've made some of the obvious choices. I'm careful about not buying water in plastic. I try to be, but then I end up having to do it oftentimes. I'm also trying to create a garden with my sister so we can grow something in soil we think is good. And it's about looking up and recognizing that, like the gentleman said, you know, it's like the ocean entering through the screen door right now. And you have to be careful what you're choosing, but there's just so much happening so quickly. I don't think that even critically thinking aware people such as ourselves are aware how quick things are cracking right now and changes are going to come. Water is the commodity. It will be probably the last huge commodity on planet Earth by corporate structures. But in Tokyo are walking around with nosebleeds right now. You know that?
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
that?
Okay,
but,
thank
oh,
you.
Yeah.
And Rob, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I don't think water will be the last great commodity. I think air, we haven't even started taxing air yet. But I haven't made particular changes in my buying habits. I'm not sure how valuable that is. I wanted to ask one question of everybody on your panel.
Go ahead, quickly, though. We only have 2 minutes left.
If you don't mind.
Go ahead.
The bigger picture, we're down in the weeds right now, and I'm kind of a 10,000-foot view kind of guy. The reality is that we've got the Koch brothers' reign of terror going on, and it's all about gazillionaires owning our government. And my question is, you know, what's the solution to the fundamental problem?
Go ahead, Frank.
Yes,
As quickly as you can, sir.
Yes. Speaking about the reign of terror from the Koch brothers, I did read something today that there are people suggesting basically that there's a certain portion of the U.S. code that starts to be leveled against some of these people for sedition, for physically injuring our country through this economic.
Gwen?
Hello. I have to say that total global paradigm shift.
Okay.
It's going to take
Hans?
Huh? Not a thing. It's been an enjoyable conversation tonight. Thank you, Rick.
Okay. Well, Rob, I'm sorry we're not going to be able to get an answer from everybody. Thank you all so much for joining me. Let me just remind you there's...
Rick.
You're very welcome. There's some great progressive broadcasters out there. Gwen Holden-Berry, her show, make sure you tune in. Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show, Progress for Democracy. Anita Stewart, her Wise Women Media. Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Sita Bigwheel and Sita Media. Harriet Lerman, The Voice of the People. Rob Abston, Smile, It's Only Politics. Thank you all so much for joining me, and I hope you tune in again soon. And with that, thank you, my guests, once again. I appreciate all of your wisdom that you shared with us, and have a very good evening. We'll talk to you next week. And here we go with a little out music. We have